Hello and welcome to the Rambling Runner Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Chittum, and this is the podcast for all the dedicated amateur runners out there who are working hard to get better while balancing running with the rest of their lives. And I am really excited today to talk about a brand new series that we have here on the Rambling Runner Show. So every 2 weeks, so every Friday, every other week, we're going to be doing a series called My Favorite Workouts. And this series is going to entail me talking to some elite coaches and runners about the two workouts that they love most. When it's an elite runner, it'll be the workouts that they love to do. And when it's a coach, it's going to be about workouts that they love to prescribe to their athletes. And in addition to that, we're making this series as available to people as possible. And by that, I mean, when someone goes through the workouts that they like, we're going to figure out exactly how this workout can pertain to runners of all abilities. So that's why I'm so excited. That's why we're limiting it to two, because we really want to dive into each workout specifically and then extrapolate what that workout can mean to so many people, no matter their fitness level or the races that they're trying to do. So I'm so excited for this. Also, as with every episode here on the Rambling Runner Podcast, is brought to you by ASICS. Go to ASICS.com for some of the best running shoes in the game. I love these shoes so much. I have dozens of pairs over the course of, the last 20 years of my running life. This has been my go-to brand for a very long time, and I'm so glad that they're supporting the show. And you can support the show by going to ASICS.com today, picking out shoes that you love, also by giving a rating and review over on Instagram, over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It may seem like a small thing. It's not. It means a lot. It really does influence who listens to, not only who listens to the show, but also the sponsors that sponsor the show. All right, it feeds into the algorithm, and it really helps me out as well as any other podcast you like. So if you have a podcast that you really like, go give it a rating and review, not just for me, but for all of them, because it really does help. Now let's get into my first episode on the My Favorite Workout series with a great coach, friend, and all around great person, David Roach. All right, David Roach, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt. I love Rambling Runner. I love everything you're doing. It's an honor to be here.
So My Favorite Workouts is the series. We're launching this. I am so excited to have you be a part of it, not only as someone who has been on this show several times, talking not only about your athletic journey, but more importantly for a lot of people, your coaching journey, because it has impacted so many people, not just on this podcast, but even more so on your own, the Some Work All Play podcast. Most people who are listening to this know you and probably know you quite well. With that said, for those few people who may not, give me a little elevator pitch about like your coaching background before we get into the workouts for today.
I love that you're giving our podcast a plug right off the top, Matt, coming in hot. We should have to pay for that. No, so I'm a coach of trail runners, road runners, track runners here in Boulder, Colorado with my wife, Megan, who's a doctor and researcher and starting some new things herself. We coach some of the best athletes in the world and then also people that are, just getting into running. So we get to run the gamut of all different types of levels of athletes and thinking all about performance and how it changes across an athletic journey.
And we should say you're also my coach. So yeah. Some of the best athletes in the world and also Matt Chittum. So.
You were included in that group.
I always like to joke about that.
LeBron, Matt, Cristiano Ronaldo, and then we go to the rest. Then it's like Grayson.
Right. It's like Emily McKay, Nikki Hiltz, and Matt Chittum combined to get a silver medal at the World Championships.
Exactly.
What's that epic line of like, me and Wilt Chamberlain scored 101 points?
Yeah. No, I love that so much.
All right. So let's dive into it. People who haven't heard this series yet, basically David's going to talk about two of his favorite workouts. I know it's kind of a hard construction because first of all, David has more than two. In fact, he came, I think, with eight. So we're going to limit it to two with that said. Also, I think the thing that's really nice about this series is diving into these workouts to see how they would be constructed for athletes at different levels and different points in a certain cycle, depending on their race. Also, the different permutations that can go into like the recovery periods, the paces, and things like that. So David, let's start where you want to start. Where should we kick off?
I'm going to start with the bread and butter for SWAP, like our coaching team, which almost every athlete sees a number of times throughout seasons, careers, over decades in the course of some of our athletes that were there from the beginning. And this is just a simple 1 minute on, 1 minute off. I'm going to say for the purposes of the podcast, we'll call it 16 by 1 minute fast, 1 minute easy. And just starting there, and then there's infinite amounts of permutations off that. But in general, we're saying athletes can start around 10K effort on the very first one, crank down towards 5K effort, and then just flow through those intervals. You don't want to have to go too slow on the recoveries. You want to be able to still run your normal easy pace. You want to feel really relaxed through this session. By the end, you'll be grinding a little bit, but the ultimate session to just, you know, re-engage your neuromuscular system with biomechanical output. And the reason it's kind of bread and butter is because, you know, on one hand, it makes a ton of sense for road and track runners to always be in touch with their 5K style speed, even when they're training for things like marathons. But even for our trail runners who are doing 100 miles of like Western states or things like that, they also need to continue to build that running economy. So kind of the midweek workout that everyone will see many times over.
And when you talk about 5K to 10K pace, especially with these 1 minute intervals, how do you want people to feel in that context? Because first of all, with 1 minute intervals, especially with GPS watches, you know, you're not going to get perfect data there, especially if you're looking at it during the rep. But that's obviously, you know, fraught with a lot of noise that can come from your watch. But even after the fact can get a little tough. So how do you want people to think of 5K, 10K effort in these shorter rep periods?
I never want athletes to think about pace at any point in the process. So in other words, I don't give a fuck about their watches. Like, they can use a Timex for all I care, and I'll be really happy with the session, as long as they're engaging with the effort. So we're, as coaches, even for the times when we're coaching athletes that are competing, trying to get to the Olympics on the track, like, we are heavily focused on the effort and then calibrating the effort. So what that feels like is the type of flowing speed where you're not straining, you're not feeling it in your arms, but you are doing work and hitting close to like the VO2 feeling where your breath rate is pretty much maximized. You're getting as much oxygen in as you possibly can. And then the way we calibrate that is, one, we don't want to fade across the intervals. We want the last one to be just as fast, hopefully faster than at first. And then two, how did the athlete feel? Just engage with that. I find that there's so much of this pace framework that comes into running, both in terms of instantaneous on your watches or even examining workouts after the fact, that absolutely does not correlate with the subsequent physiological stress or adaptations. The body does not know the difference. Our brains do. And our brains put this framework of adaptation onto it. So we try to take that away from athletes, even in some of the track workouts that I might say as permutations of this. Often we'll say, don't look at your watch, run the session on feel, and then we'll calibrate after on your GPS just based on how things went when it's necessary. But rarely is it necessary. Instead, let yourself be light, let your running be joyous, and engage with effort, not pace.
And when you say on and off, you hinted at this already. Talk about the recovery periods and why it's more of a jogging recovery than as opposed to, say, a walking recovery.
So at baseline, we like your recoveries on almost all the intervals I'm talking about to be essentially your easy running pace. You're on the slow end of your easy running pace, but that is a natural governor for how fast you're going on the intervals, first of all, that you can't push the interval too hard. If you need to walk after, you're just absolutely ignoring the types of adaptations we're looking at. You're creating way too much lactate that you're not going to be able to clear anyway. Two, we just think it's a wonderful time to continue the aerobic stimulus. Basically, recoveries are a huge opportunity, and more in coaching, maybe we're getting to longer recoveries even, but keeping those recoveries at nice natural pace for the most part, just because it's an opportunity to make sure you have this governor on your workout, keeping the emphasis on the aerobic end of the spectrum. And maybe that's the biggest key of all, is that by doing that with recoveries, you're saying, okay, we want everything that comes from these workouts to be aerobic, that you're building this from the bottom up, not the top down, even in short intervals. And by doing that, we're making sure athletes aren't, you know, absolutely frying their mitochondria with lactate for no reason.
Yeah. And I can imagine someone doing this for the first time. I don't have to imagine. I've done this workout for the first time because you're my coach. And even coming back to it after a layoff, or if I haven't done it in a while, it's so easy to juice the first three or four reps because, again, it's only 1 minute. So it's so easy to really pick it up hard. And, you know, so many of us, you know, at the beginning of a workout tend to go into it, especially if we're warmed up well, really feeling good. So when you have this idea of making sure that it's really hitting the aerobic side of things, as opposed to the VO2 max side of things, what do you talk to athletes about when they have a tendency to, again, maybe overreach at either the whole workout or at different points in the workout?
I mean, it's one place that we try to trust athletes. Like, I think handholding as a coach is only effective insofar as you're helping the athlete learn and grow. And I think usually if you're saying to an athlete anything beyond like, hey, I'm so worried about you, be careful about this, those types of coaches are coaching from a place of insecurity and being controlling. And that's not a way to for that athlete to develop the skill set they need. So I'm just direct about the types of efforts I want. If they fade on intervals or something, it's like, well, clearly that's a problem. If they're not recovering from these sessions, clearly that's a problem. And then you have a little bit of an intervention. But basically, I try to be relatively hands-off in the prescription process, because part of my role, I think, is in helping that athlete develop the sense of feel that is an indispensable tool. And I think it's one place where the pace discussion also comes in handy. It's like when athletes become reliant on these watches to tell them whether they're good or not or whatever, not only is that bad for mental health, you're dropping like the main skill that ends up being useful across an athletic journey, no matter what your fitness context is. So in general, athletes will learn by putting their hand on the stove, and that's okay.
Now, are there certain times where you would want athletes to maybe vary up the topography of where they're doing this kind of workout? I mean, to think of 1 minute on, 1 minute off, this certainly isn't something that has to be done on a track, if not maybe even pushing people away from the track.
Yeah, that's the magic of these types of sessions, is that you can have so many fun variations off it. So at baseline, we'll just talk about the 16x1:1. You can also go up all the way to 20 or even 30x1:1 for more aerobic sessions, or for beginner athletes, 10x1:1. Like, if you're out there and you are just trying, like, I want to try a workout, it's like, that's the type of place to start. But the next permutation is varying terrain. So put this type of session over hills, over hilly terrain, and you're getting tons of mechanical stimuli from the ups and the downs and the variation. You could even put it on trails, though we generally leave, even for our athletes that are competing at the world-class level in trails, try to leave our workouts off the trails for the most part, other than long tempos, because their output is lower. And so you're getting a little bit less of that muscular stimulus. The other way you can really vary this is by floating the recoveries. So that's probably the next step up that we often take for more advanced athletes, is the recoveries themselves will be a little bit easier than marathon effort. And then the fasts will stay more around 10K effort. And that's the type of heavily aerobic session where you're clearing lactate on the fly that can make this the type of speed session that also then applies directly into things like half marathons and road marathons. And so once you start floating the intervals, you get even more aerobic stimulus, and that's really, really productive. Or to get like a final level up, you can have a little bit of a recovery period after this, and then throw in something like 4 to 6x30-second harder hills, where athletes are actually pushing quite hard to get the muscular stimulus on top of this really good speed stimulus.
So at the end, that last permutation you just mentioned, why would you go hills at the end as opposed to say just shorter, faster reps on flat ground?
Well, so the body's already tired at that point. And I don't like athletes doing pure speed when their body's tired necessarily, unless they're training for kicks in track and field at the like elite level where they're needing to close insanely fast. And even then, that's just in moderation to get the feel for it. I only want athletes to do pure flat speed when they're relatively fresh, when they're not too tired, because why are we going to train inefficiency? But the great thing about hills is you get all of the output, or even more, because the great adjusted pace on those hills is often much faster than an athlete would do a 30-second flatter stride. But you also get the major mechanical stress from it. Like, you know, it's why we're such huge fans of hill strides outside of this. Like, you know, if I was going to play, you know, be like kind of a little bit of a douchebag on this podcast, I would say hill strides is our workout, but that we're not counting that. But the idea just being that by throwing in hard hills at the end, you're getting the speed stimulus on fresh legs and then the power stimulus on a little bit more tired legs. So you're getting full muscle fiber recruitment. And it's a way that almost turns these types of running workouts into power generation workouts, almost like plyometrics, but much more specific to the work we're doing.
I love that. All right, let's dive into the second one.
Can I throw in a few more permutations off that really quickly?
Absolutely.
Though?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's not just 1:1. I mean, minutes are random, right? Like, that's not, we're just trying to control an uncontrollable universe when we even say what a minute is. So you can do a lot more different ideas off this, but essentially what we're trying to say is that 15 to 20-ish minutes of total work is a sweet spot for most athletes when they're thinking about that zone, a little 5K effort or a little bit easier, up to like 10K effort, that sort of true speed type training, where you're starting to hit, you know, zone five in, you know, five zone models. So good examples of what that can look like are sets of descending ladders. Another one that we do a ton is 4 or 5 sets by 90 seconds, 60 seconds, 30 seconds on with 1 minute easy between. Another one that you can vary a lot of different ways: the 90 second at 10K effort, the 60 second at 5K effort, the 30 second at 3K effort. It's one that athletes really like, has applied really well to athletes that are like winning world championships in trails or competing on the track really high. Another one is something with floats that is a really heavy aerobic workout, something like 10 by 2 minutes on around 10K to 1 hour effort. So you're thinking more threshold at that point with a 90 second float recovery. One of those floats, I think, can make workouts really fun because it does allow you to take some of the emphasis off the intervals, makes it a little bit less stressful for athletes that sometimes struggle to get into these faster sessions or don't respond to faster sessions, which might be like aging athletes or injury prone athletes or things like that. And then the final one is what I call the Megan special, which is a track workout that she introduced me to way back when she went from field hockey to walking onto the Duke track team. And in her very, like her second week on the team, she was like sixth or something at the ACC 10K championships. And the only track workout she did, it was a few weeks of 5 by 800, 400, 200, much like the 90, 60, 30 breakdown. So in other words, chunking up your, this type of work can really work well for athletes as well.
And I feel like by varying up the distances and or the times, it also helps just the mentality of going to workout instead of like the monotony of doing the same thing over and over again, whether that's like we can do so many different permutations here to talk about that. But I think that also it helps people stay engaged, right?
Yeah.
Whereas like, hey, if you do that descending ladder by 4 or 5 times, it does feel different than like 20 by 1 minute on and off. You're like, wait, hold on, how many have I done right now? And it's like, this feels like a never ending slog, even if it's going fairly well.
That's why I like the ones, actually, because you can essentially lose track of it. And it's 1 minute is such an approachable amount of time that I find that even if you give athletes a huge number of intervals, like sometimes on someone's 33rd birthday, they'll get 33 by 1:1 just for fun. And usually,
good luck, masters athletes.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, we've done that before. I think we hit 68 once. I haven't done it over that. But on that type of session, you know, 1 minute's a really easy amount of time to conceive of. If you're just going by your watch, it's really like you just get in the rhythm and it's good. I think once you start getting longer, sets become a huge help. The main place that I see this being relevant is when athletes are cross training, let's say. So if you're on the elliptical, 10 by 3 minutes can be just the most mind-numbingly hard workout that you've ever seen. But a workout that's really fun for people that seems easier is 3 by 4, 3, 2, 1 minutes. So I actually really, really like, the more I coach, chunking up intervals into different types of sets. One, because it gives slightly varying stimuli, like the athlete doesn't feel the pressure to maintain paces and they're really keying into their effort. But two, that emotional side of how you're thinking about the workout can be really, really helpful in like harnessing the true purpose of it. So I like to give even athletes I coach, like even if my workout doesn't have sets, sometimes you can add sets. Like that 10 by 2 minute workout, if you want to add 3 minutes easy in the middle of it, be my guest if it makes it more fun.
There you go. All right. That was great. Thank you so much for diving into all the different variations off the 16 by 1:1. I guess, where do you want to go next?
Okay, let's go to our second workout. Another one that SWAT might be known for, which is the hill to tempo combination workout, or hill to threshold combination workout. So the traditional one that is very, very difficult, so we'll go to both directions after, is something like 5 by 3 minute hills, where you're thinking 10K effort again, maybe even a little bit more effort if an athlete feels okay. Because usually on hills, people will go a little bit harder, like 5K effort with rundown recovery after each one. Anyone who's done 5 by 3 minute hills, that's a good workout in and of itself. It's a wonderful session for aerobic development, for power development, for road, for trails, for everything. But the wrinkle here that I wanted to add, because it's my favorite workouts, is after that, you take a few minutes of extra easy recovery after you get down, and then you do a 15-minute moderate tempo at threshold effort. So the body has already accumulated lactate, it's already accumulated fatigue, and then we're making it clear that lactate on the fly, much like the float type stimulus earlier. But that threshold style effort is the ultimate race preparation stimulus. I find that athletes that can perform well in this workout will excel at any level of competition, whether it's, you know, going for a top 10 at Western States or road racing. And one of the most fascinating things about this session in particular is the first time someone does it, it's almost always a little bit of a shit show. They're just like, that was hard. I didn't like it. It wasn't very fun. But the second time they do it, if they do the same route, we'll see sometimes 10 to 20% improvement on the threshold effort after. And what we're probably seeing is part of it's neuromuscular and nervous system, so that adapts fast. But then the lactate clearance abilities under duress, much like you'll feel in a race, actually do adapt much more quickly than like background aerobic processes. So a little bit of a magic workout. Hopefully our trail competitors don't take it up too much.
All right. When you say rundown recovery, what does that mean?
So basically how we do all of our hill intervals, which a lot of in our team, is an athlete on the very first one, let's say a 3-minute hill, you go up at the appropriate effort, you run for the duration of time it is, and you look at your watch and you find like some landmark. And instead of running each subsequent one for the same amount of time, what you do is you mark that landmark, you run down to the bottom where you started. So you just finish the interval, you could be hands on knees for a second if you want. Gives you like just a nice mental reset, and then jog down. So at this point, like, you know, just recover on the whole way down. It'll probably be a little bit shorter amount of time than it took you to get up, because downhills are easy. But
you're not pushing the downhill. You're not pushing. Is it easy jog? Okay.
Run down recovery, just nice and relaxed. Just run as is natural for you. And then once you get to the bottom, turn around and run to that same spot again. So you're not looking at your watch after the very first interval. That way you're not racing yourself, which can be so terrible on hill intervals, because like one, even a well-executed hill workout will often have fade interval after interval, because now we're not talking about aerobic stimulus. We're talking about mechanical stimulus, so muscular demand. And so it takes an athlete with pretty wild fatigue resistance and slow twitch predisposition not to fade across well-executed hill intervals just a little bit, or they have to be racing at the end to maintain where they're going. So we just like to take that off the plate for athletes and not have them think about it. Plus it's just a little bit of less watch peaking.
Yeah. I would say, as someone who's done this, I would say like doing the whole landmark thing, it definitely, there's enough to worry about when you're redlining on a hill workout. The last thing you need to be doing is like, wait, how much longer? Where am I going? And all that stuff.
Same goes for things like hill strides, you know, like if someone's doing a 20 or 30 second hill stride, know how far it is and then just do that. Like, don't get bogged down in staring at watches. I think that's especially important when for coaches that plan a lot by time, which is how we do a majority of our work, though not all of it. Because like, I don't care about the specific number, it's the principles of it. And so athletes need to kind of figure out their own way to make sure that the watch peaking, even though time is usually less mentally draining, that the watch peaking doesn't make them, you know, almost start to view themselves as a math equation.
Yeah, absolutely. And then talk to me about the incline of the hill that you're looking for and how this may change depending on the athlete or if it doesn't change.
So in general, with hill intervals, we recommend 6 to 8% average grade would be an ideal world. Not too technical. You know, it could be a road hill, anything like that. But have fun with it. It can be a shallower grade if you don't have those types of hills where you are. Basically, the magic of hills is that one, it reduces impact forces, which is great for overall health. But two, it engages the musculature much more. So there's a much higher power stimulus. So, you know, the shallower grade might have a little bit less power stimulus, but on the flip side, you're getting the trade-off of a better neuromuscular biomechanical stimulus. So the reason we don't go really steep on these too often is that you have to slow down so much that, yeah, there's a really good stimulus, but it's like mostly not necessarily directly applicable to going pretty fast. And we want this to be the type of workout that can apply to athletes that are doing road 10Ks, not just athletes that are doing trail races. But when athletes do really steep trail races, hell yeah, we layer it up and say same workout, same types of workouts, and we say steep hills. And when we say steep hills, we essentially mean as steep as they can get while still being able to run up it. So often 12 to 15% grade for those athletes.
All right. Now the time, say after the fifth rep, so you're 5 by 3 minute hills with jog down recovery. Again, not pushing the hills, pushing the downhill. This isn't about eccentric loading. Yeah. You jog down say that takes 2.5 minutes, right? Yeah. So an additional, 1 or 2 minutes before you get into the threshold?
Yeah, usually it's like 3 minutes or so. Just enough to regroup, clear a little, like whatever of that lactate might be above the second threshold. So like if an athlete pushed, you know, when we take that lactate readings on this, sometimes you'll see, you know, an athlete's carrying around 5.5 millimoles of lactate. Usually they can get down pretty quickly with a little bit more time. So just relaxing for a little bit, just jogging around, and then get straight into the threshold. So I said initially 15 minutes at threshold effort. So just a relaxed tempo. It should be the type of thing that, you know, you're fatigued, so it's not as easy as it would be on fresh legs, but it's not a race. But the threshold after for a very advanced athlete. So like for a very advanced athlete, 15 minutes at threshold is actually a ton of work because they're so fast. Like if an athlete's threshold pace is, you know, or, you know, 4:45 minutes per mile, like I'm not going to want them to do that effort after. I might do 3x1 mile with 2 minutes easy recovery or something like that. And for more beginner athletes, it's much easier to just do it straight as a tempo.
Right. And just from a defining your terms perspective, people might already know this. How do you define threshold pace when you say, so do, say 15 minutes at threshold?
1 hour effort, essentially. So it's aerobic, so it shouldn't actually feel too difficult until it gets difficult. And when I say threshold to athletes, I always want them to err on the side of a little bit easier at the start, working into it, learning their body. And usually you get a good feel for it when you say, okay, I could sustain that for about an hour. So threshold is an art that is one of the things that as coaches, we are trying to get athletes to really understand, but without pricking their ears every, you know, few minutes to have like an exact number, because that number changes way too much on a day-to-day basis to truly know, unless we're training in a controlled setting like the track or treadmill or something like that. And then, you know, that type of training style becomes like a freaking drag a lot of the time anyway. So this is a feel-based thing where you're not accumulating lactate. You feel good, but you do start to get tired as the effort goes on.
So you don't want to be Michele Ferrari sitting there at the bottom of the hill? I'm going to take that part out. Don't worry.
Oh, no. I love that joke. Can we keep it in? Are we allowed to keep it in?
All right, fine. All right. People who don't know Michele Ferrari
the doctor of Lance Armstrong?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's who I thought. I was like, this better not be a car guy. Yeah, so actually I read a great, great book for people out there that are curious about the history of endurance sports development is The Secret Race by Tyler Hamilton. And Ferrari plays a little bit of like a side role in it because Ferrari was the doctor of Lance. And, you know, Lance was coached by Chris Carmichael. And so I got the book that Lance and Chris Carmichael wrote way back when I was young. And I learned all about training theory when I was coming from football. I was like, I'm going to learn so much. Yeah, it comes out later on that Carmichael had nothing to do with it. Ferrari was the one giving him all the EPO and all the HGH and all the testosterone and all the training. And Carmichael was just, you know, doing his thing in the background, cashing checks. So Ferrari is an interesting character.
Worked out well for him. He was the highest paid beard in the game.
Yeah, I mean, he seems like a good guy. I'm not saying like casting no aspersions there, but I am just saying like interesting world out there in endurance training theory development. When you think about like, you know, so much of what might have come down, like actually that's one of the, I saw this morning, I don't know when this is going to come out, but Matt and Kara Goucher had a little back and forth on Twitter about some of the recent announcements of doping positives. And Kara was saying about how it is a negative for any athlete, of course, you know, that you're competing against these people. And Matt responded with a really insightful point too, that like, it makes it also hard to celebrate things in the sport. And totally agree. I mean, anyone who follows endurance sports agrees, but I think one thing that's often overlooked is how much the history of doping has changed the way we think about training theory, but without anyone talking, like being open about what that actually means. So I think a lot of the training theory you see publicized is essentially interpolated from outliers. So they're interpolating from people that are at the very top. And so hopefully most of them are clean, but just statistically, many are not. And there are some coaches in particular that have coached more, you know, fewer clean athletes or have philosophies that are based less on the principles of clean athletes. So it's sometimes when you hear about training theory, you have to take it all with a grain of salt because you're like, okay, is that for humans or is that for horses? Because there's a difference.
Well said. That is for
okay,
sure.
Okay, was it okay? I just went on a soapbox for no reason.
I love all of that. And all of these books that you're referencing, I've read them all. Like I've okay, listened to The Longest Race or The Secret Race by Tyler Hamilton, I think 8 times. Like I love that book so much.
It actually made me love Tyler Hamilton. Like if anyone's like, even though obviously he did really, unethical things, it also just gave me a lot of empathy for anyone that's put in situations that are kind of get out of control. So maybe the little aside, the final end thing here is anyone that's ever, done something where you let yourself or others down, cut yourself slack and try to forgive yourself. Like it is not worth, life is short. We all die. It is not worth like thinking you're anything other than awesome because you are, and our mistakes do not define us.
Right. Also, don't die on the 15-minute threshold, right? Yes, threshold saves people. Threshold saves.
Yeah. So off that, though, there are tons of different principles. And so the final way I want to end this is just with talking about how we incorporate threshold work across different types of sessions. So the main way that I wanted to mention is descending ladders. So I mentioned a little bit before, like 2x5, 4, 3, 2, 1, things like that. So when you take lactate measurements of people, often the lactate obviously increases as the session goes on. But let's read that in tandem with the corollary that when you do short intervals, threshold or lactate has much less time to increase. So it gives you more margin for error. That's why in traditional Norwegian double threshold sessions, the afternoon session has shorter intervals. So they can go a little faster, but without accumulating above their LT2. Those same principles can apply to anyone that's trying to do traditional, more aerobic heavy threshold work in how you approach it. So let's imagine a hypothetical 6x5 minutes. Even if you pace that pretty well, if you're not insanely aerobically efficient, like one of these Norwegian pros, by the end of that, you're going to be probably accumulating way too much lactate for it to be that type of session. And some studies have come out looking at elite athlete training that says long intervals are the least correlated with long-term growth. And the reason is because if you do a long, hard interval, you're starting to kind of annihilate some of that aerobic development. So how can you harness those principles while still getting the threshold work in? I love descending ladders because the intervals get shorter as you get more fatigued. So you're probably accumulating less lactate and a little bit more adept at managing effort. So good example of, a lot of workouts call for 20 to 40 minutes of threshold work. Let's say you're doing 30 minutes, something like 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 with 90 seconds, very easy recovery. And when you're doing threshold work, keep recovery very easy. That type of session can be a really good lactate control session that can be done on any type of terrain. Since when we're thinking about threshold, we're not thinking about pace or like mechanical output as much. We're thinking more about the aerobic system. I just shot a lot of paint at the wall there. I'm sorry about that.
No, I love that. And I love also you talked about like, I would say the 6x5 model could be a really harsh stimulus, even if you categorize it as threshold, again, depending on the kind of athlete, right? Because you have some people who would say they were 5 minutes at threshold, that I'll just look at myself, right? That basically would be like 1K repeats, essentially, is what that would be. So that's not a huge distance for 5 minutes, right? But you have some other people that you coach might be going, 1.15 miles in that same time gap, where all of a sudden you're talking about a much more distance at pace.
But I think the complicated thing is that athlete that, if they're really aerobically efficient, so someone like, let's say Drew Holman or Eli Hemming or whatever, they barely produce lactate unless they are sprinting. Like they're so aerobically efficient. So for them, threshold workouts can basically look like anything. As long as like you're being smart and still building speed, they're not going to produce lactate basically no matter what you do. He's superhuman. Whereas like a beginner athlete or an athlete that's, working really hard, but not like a faster twitch athlete, let's say. So even advanced, even a pro faster twitch athlete like myself, I'm going to be producing lactate on that session almost no matter how easy I go, unless I go very easy. And so for someone like me, descending ladder makes a little more sense. So most athletes are working within that framework where they're not an Olympic slow twitch athlete. And for them, I just think we have to think about how we structure workouts and what that does to the underlying physiology. And so this is where things like longer intervals first can be really beneficial, unless you're trying to work on the lactate clearance stimulus, like on the hills. And if you're working on the lactate clearance stimulus, you always err on the side of easier to start because it's very easy to just kind of get in these runaway processes of lactate generation.
This has been incredibly helpful. David, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking all about this. If people want to learn more about you, Swap, Megan, and all of your coaching principles, where should they go?
Just go to the Some Work All Play podcast, click follow. But most importantly, if you're listening to this right now, go to Rambling Runner, give it 5 stars and write that you love Matt or something like that. Those little reviews really, really make a difference. And I know sometimes it's easy to play them off, but it's like the number one thing you can do to support any podcast you listen to. So go give Rambling Runner the best rating you've ever given.